We want you to know that you are more than welcome to go to lunch with us, and we hope that you will. And you are more than welcome to come out to the Scott Farm tonight. And I know it's only an acre, but we have a ton of animals, so it's a legit farm. Most of those animals die because I don't know what I'm doing, but Philip knows that my dream job is to be a farmer. I think I've told him that before, and he's always like, why? You know, he grew up on a farm. But after just trying to keep up with an acre, my dream job is not to be a farmer anymore. It is crazy. But all you college students, we really want what we desire for you, and when our pursuit, maybe our core mission in this ministry, is for you to become a part of this family. And that's what we really hope and try to accomplish, is your 4 or 5 years at OU, for you to become a part of the family here at Westside. You can go on events, you can come and join us for lunch, and that's all great, but really we want you to find your place in the body here, find a home here. I can't tell you how great this family is. I wish I could like plug you in like the Matrix and just upload what I know about this family in your brain, but that's not possible. Just for you to experience it and to jump in. Don't isolate yourself. That seems to be the great temptation for college students these days, is to isolate themselves away from any sort of family, especially the family of Christ. And what a shame, what a waste. And we want you to make an effort. We're going to make an effort to pursue you. We want you to make an effort to be a part of this family, and you will not regret it. You will love these people, and they will love you back, and you will be extremely blessed in your 4 to 5 years here at OU, and we will help you any way that you can, any way that we can. All right, the text I picked this morning, I read an article. I was reading some different articles on this, and one article described this the toughest text or the hardest text in the Bible. And I'm sitting there thinking, why in the world did I choose this? I don't know how to answer that question. I just like this text. I've always wanted to preach on it. And so this is the text I chose for this morning. So this morning we're going to camp out in Luke chapter 14, starting in verse 25. Let me read that again for us. Now great crowds accompanied him. And he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, going out to encounter another king in war, will not sit down first and deliberate whether he's able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the others are yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, anyone who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. How are you feeling this morning? A little sad now, aren't you? It's a tough text. How many of you hear this and maybe you squirm a little bit? You know, we'd rather focus on the nice, comfortable, grace and mercy-centered text rather than something like this. But I believe that when we hear Jesus talk like this, he actually meant for us to be uncomfortable. He wants us to squirm a little bit, because the language he uses here is pretty powerful. And the reason I believe a lot of us are uncomfortable with this, or a lot of us read this and we squirm a little bit, primarily comes from a misunderstanding of who Jesus is and what he came to do, and also what he's calling us to do as well. And so I want us to move into this text and clear out some of the confusion and the clutter associated with this text. And I want us to focus really on what Jesus is saying and also on what he's not saying. Now, one of the main reasons I believe that we avoid this text and we're uncomfortable with this text is because we view Scripture through the lens of our modern culture, and we read it that way, and therefore sometimes we misunderstand it. Think about it this way. We're in an election year, if you haven't noticed. I'm sure you have. So you and I, we're bombarded with political ads. We're bombarded with commercials. We're bombarded with interviews, all pulling us to vote for one candidate or the other. And there is a third candidate out there, by the way. And maybe you go to YouTube or whatever, and you're watching these speeches of your favorite politician, and they're telling you, vote for me. Vote for me for this reason and this reason and this reason. And you think, yeah, I want to vote for that person. They have my interest in mind. But what if they were to say, what if you were to sit down and watch an interview with your favorite politician? What if they said this? What if they said, vote for me, and if you do, more than likely, things are going to become extremely difficult for you. You will experience severe hardship. You will likely lose relationships and possessions. Your closest family ties might suffer if you vote for me. And guess what? You might even lose your life. Vote for me. That's not going to go over well, is it? You're probably not going to vote for that person. You would think, that person is off the rocker. They're crazy. They need a new speechwriter or maybe a new PR person. They need to do something differently. But you see, you're like, I would never do that. Why? Because the office, in theory, of a politician is the office of a civil servant, right? So we have a vision of, we have our own vision of what the good life looks like. And therefore, we're going to vote and support the politician that best represents and supports our view of what a good life looks like. And so we would never vote for a politician that said those things, because we want to vote for someone that can actually make our lives better. And I think many of us, and actually most of us at some point, we actually view Jesus more like a politician that we voted for. And so when we read what he preaches through that lens, we misunderstand what he's saying. Some people come to Jesus because they're aware that they have problems in their life that they need fixed. You know, and they did all these right things and they believed in him and they're baptized and they become religious and they wanted their life to improve. And then when their life falls apart and their prayers aren't answered, at least in what the way that they wanted them to be, and they're faced with all of their problems again, then all of a sudden they become jaded. They become discouraged and they say, I voted for you, Jesus. I petitioned you. I prayed to you. I actually gave money to your cause and everything. And this is what I get. I'm still having the same problems I had before I joined your team. And that's how you know you're viewing Jesus that way. As someone who's coming along to actually serve your vision of what a good life looks like. When in reality, we are here to serve his vision of what a good life looks like. I would argue that Jesus is more like a skilled mountain guide. You ever seen these men and women who climb Mount Everest? They can't do it without a mountain guide. They know the terrain. The guy knows the terrain. It's kind of like Jesus has this small group of people up in the Rockies, and you know, he sees this storm coming. He sees this storm forming, and he says to this group of people, you need to follow me. I need you to listen very carefully. If you want to live, you need to follow me. Now, if you follow me, things are going to be very tough. They're going to be very hard. You're going to need to shed some gear because we're going to have to move fast. We're going to have to move hard. And some of you, if you follow me, you might even die. But you need to follow me. And you see, if we put ourselves in that kind of scenario, then this exact same speech all of a sudden takes on a very different meaning, doesn't it? Because the person giving the speech, he doesn't have his own interest in mind. He's concerned about me, and he's concerned about you. He has our long-term well-being in mind at the expense of our short-term comfort. You see, he may be calling me to do things that are very difficult, things that are very dangerous, and I may not even survive, but they're actually things that lead to true life. They're actually things that lead to eternal life. Perhaps Jesus is much more like a skilled mountain guide trying to rescue me from the storm that's coming than he is like a politician who I expect to make my life better if I follow him. And so he has every right to say these things to me because he knows the terrain. He's been up this path. He knows the dangers ahead. And he's trying to save me, and he's trying to save you from the wrong valleys and the dead end canyons so that we can actually find true life in him. That makes sense? Now, reading it in that light, I want to jump back into these verses and see if we can peel back a few layers of what he's saying here and camp out here a second and get at what he is saying and what he's not saying. Verse 25 is very telling even in and of itself. Now, great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, and then he unleashes these brutal statements to him. So a little context here. Jesus is heading to Jerusalem. A few chapters earlier, we're told that he turns his face towards Jerusalem. And on his way, he is stopping in all of these towns, all of these little villages, and he's teaching people, and he's healing people, and he's performing miracles. And so what naturally happens is he has all of these people, these small groups that follow him. It's kind of like Forrest Gump when he goes for a run. He just continues to gather people, you know, behind him. And so he has all this huge crowd following him. Now think about this. The crowd that is around Jesus, they have all kinds of agendas for Jesus. They have their own agendas, and they have all these projections that they're putting upon Jesus. They think he's amazing. Don't get me wrong. They think he's wonderful. He's a sensational teacher. He says things that nobody else says. They're very much attracted to him because of the things that he's done for them and the way that he's healed them. Does that mean that everybody in the crowd actually gets Jesus? No. And is actually a follower of Jesus? No, not at all. Because this is the same crowd, right? This is the same crowd that will later on call him the Messiah when he rides into Jerusalem on a donkey and they're all excited. And then they become jaded, they become upset when he doesn't overthrow Rome, when he's not claiming the throne. And then he calls himself the Son of God, and he claims to be from God and claims to be equal with God. And that's really going to tick them off. It's the same crowd that would later on yell, crucify him in front of Pontius Pilate. Same crowd. So to be in the crowd does not mean that you're a disciple of Jesus. Did you get that? And this is a very important distinction. And Jesus often does this. When he has crowds gather around him, he will often say very strange and very difficult things in order to sift the crowd. Why? Because he knows that a crowd is not the same thing as a church. And he knows that an attendee, somebody physically following him, is not the same thing as a devoted disciple. So he did this intentionally. Not because he's a jerk, but because he's a guide who wants to make sure that they're going to follow him on the right path. And he wants them to pay attention. So he turns to the crowd, and this is fascinating. Watch what he says. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Now, let's talk about this a sec. Because there are some things in here, I think, that trip us up sometimes, and they may still trip some of us up. Jesus' goal is clear. He's here to sift the crowd. Because he wants them to become his what? His disciples, right? Now, the Greek term for a disciple is mathetes. It's a learner, essentially. A better English word, or a better descriptive English word, is apprentice. Somebody who you're an adherent. You literally follow the things and the way they act and the patterns of their life. So you don't just like happen to become a disciple of somebody. That's not how this happens. You choose to. You make a choice to. You have to want to, and then you have to act on that desire to do so. You have to do something about it. Some of you might, you have a strong desire for world peace or world hunger or to solve world hunger, and that's great, but it's only a sentiment if you don't actually do something about it. People might have all sorts of desires and think, oh, Jesus, is so wonderful. He's so amazing. He does all these things that are just beautiful. I totally want to be associated with Jesus. I'll be in the crowd. I'm going to follow him. And Jesus is like, that's great, but I'm actually not looking for crowds. I'm looking for disciples. Jesus is intentionally sifting disciples from the crowd. And what is the first thing he goes after here? And this is probably the hardest part of this, and you're wondering why we're just now getting to it, because it's hard. I was delaying it a little bit. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he can't be my disciple. Now, Jesus often uses shocking language to make us pay attention. And everything I'm going to say to kind of put it in context here, I don't want to take away from that. He means to shock us. It's meant to be shocking. It should shock you. But the words love and hate, even in English, they're relationship words, right? They have their origin in relationship. We use these words in relationship. But even in English, the majority of the time, we don't use them literally, do we? I love Taco Casa. Little plug there for Taco Casa, Briscoe, there you go. I love the sweet tea at Taco Casa. I drink a sweet tea from Taco Casa about every day. But if I were to say, I love Taco Casa, and mean it the same way as when I say I love Amanda, we have a problem, don't we? I mean, I love Taco Casa a lot, but I've made vows to Amanda. I've entered into a covenant relationship with Amanda. You know, the super burrito, no olives, whew, that'll make your day, but it doesn't compare to Amanda. You see, we use these words, and we don't mean them literally. It's the same with hate. I hate olives. That's why I get it with no olives. The only food in the world I won't eat. I hate olives. But I also hate oppression of any sort. Same word, different meaning. So when Jesus says this, he's not telling you, hey, you need to go to your family and stand up at the dinner table and make this grand announcement. I hate you all. I'm going to follow Jesus, you know. That we read this, and sometimes that's what we think. Like, I have to stand before my family and I now follow Jesus and I hate you. No, that's not what he's talking about. Love and hate in the Jewish culture, in the lingo of Jesus's time, is a way of talking about devotion and allegiance. If I say I love one thing, it means that my ultimate allegiance and devotion is to that thing. And even though I can have allegiance and devotion to something else, in comparison to that first thing that I love, it seems like hate, right? Jesus talks this way, and he uses language like this all the time. Look at Luke chapter 16. He says, no one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You can't serve both God and money. You just can't do it. So my allegiance must be a much higher allegiance to Jesus rather than it is to family and tribe. And I use that word tribe because that's how the family unit functioned in this time. It must even be higher than my allegiance to my own life. Now watch what he does here, because this is absolutely fascinating. You see, Jesus is like a great guide, because Jesus knows, he knows that if I give my allegiance to anyone or anything other than him, I'm in trouble. I'm going to go down the wrong path. And I'm going to go down false trails of allegiance. And I'm going to end up lost. And I'm going to end up with nothing but grief. And actually, it's only when my true allegiance is to Jesus, that all my other allegiances find their true place and I discover true life. And Jesus knows this. Look at the text. It's absolutely brilliant. He says there are two things that need to be demoted. The first is family and tribe. And tribe, because that's the makeup of their family unit back then. He says, you must hate your father, mother, wife, children, but then brothers and sisters. And what Jesus does here is profound. He names the two great idols of human history. And idols, what idols are, they're good things in our lives, but we exalt them to the ultimate thing. We put them above where they belong. And in those things, we find our purpose and our identity and our meaning. And because those things or people aren't God, they will inevitably let us down or lead us down the wrong path. And so he names the two great idols, family and tribe. That's the first one. And what's the second one? Yourself or your life. Now think about Jesus's context here and the context he's speaking into. It's the first century. It's very, patriarchal. He's not talking about the traditional American family unit that we have here. He's talking to people who rely very much on the family unit or the family tribe. He's talking about a whole household here, all the way back to their great, great, great granddaddy. That's who he's covering here. Even in this culture, this culture is about honoring your family name. And everything you do is about increasing your family's wealth and increasing the honor of your family. Who you marry is set under the allegiance to family. You want to bring in good standing. You want to bring in honor. You want to bring in wealth to your family name. Your job. There's no way in this time, this day and time, that you'd move away to go to work. That would bring dishonor to your family. So you stick with the family business and you do your best at it. And you build your house under your great, great, great granddaddy's house. And there are many benefits to living in this kind of culture and having this kind of family unit. It becomes very much a safety net for them. And oftentimes, family gets exalted to that prominent position above everything else. Like oftentimes, young little Mary, back in first century world, she wouldn't want to marry some dude that she loves, or she wouldn't want to marry some dude because she doesn't love him. She wants to marry another dude that she does love, but she'll marry the dude she doesn't love for the sake of her family, because of her allegiance to her family. Or little Johnny, I don't know if anybody's named Johnny back then, Johnny. Little Johnny doesn't want to be a tent maker. He wants to move to California and write software for Google. But he can't do that because of allegiance to family. You see how this plays out? So Jesus walks into that kind of culture and just drops this bomb. What he was asking people to do in this culture was very, very out of the ordinary. But he knew that exalting the family to the place, to the ultimate place of finding meaning and identity would lead, it's going to lead to a dead end. It's going to lead to a broken heart. It's a bad trail to go down. And when the storm comes, you're going to be overtaken by the storm. Even think of us. Even in modern day evangelical Christianity, just the way that so many of us exalt marriage and exalt family, two good things, but sometimes they get exalted to the ultimate place. Family and marriage often become the ways in which we find meaning in life, don't they? We call our Christian campuses marriage factories. That's what they used to call FHU. You go there to get married because marriage is more important than anything else in life. You see, we exalt family and marriage. How many of you have met parents, or maybe you don't realize it and you are this parent, but you've come to find your whole sense of self-worth and self-identity in your role as a parent, right? And here's what's going to happen. The kids are going to grow up and they're going to disappoint their parents, because they're humans and they have free will and they make decisions. They'll have opinions that differ from yours, and they're going to make different choices than you would make, and that will break any parent's heart. It will. But the parent whose identity is tied up in their children, it will absolutely break them. It will absolutely crush them. They can't live through the guilt and the remorse because their whole sense of worth is tied up in their kids and how they raise these kids. And Jesus says, you're going down the wrong path. You've exalted that allegiance to the ultimate place. Think of marriage in our culture. The idea of marriage. If I can just find that one right person, that soulmate of mine, then find, I work with college girls. You think I don't deal with this? Then I would find fulfillment. Boo, then I'd never be lonely again. I just need to find that person that will always value me. Some of you married couples are like, yeah, right. Yeah. But when you idolize marriage like that, you're asking your potential spouse to do something that they can't possibly do. They can't be that person. It's like me going to the gas station down here on Lindsay and buying a cup of coffee and expecting it to be elemental coffee. It's just not going to happen. It's going to be a horrible cup of coffee. If you're not a coffee drinker, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But marriage is wonderful. Don't get me wrong. Amanda's the best wife in the world. But when it's exalted to that ultimate place, Jesus looks at us and he says, you're going down the wrong path. You see, when we go down these paths, when the storm comes, we end up overwhelmed and we lose our sense of where we're at and we get crushed. And then we bring Jesus into it and we say, but Jesus, you know, I prayed for you to give me a good marriage. I prayed for you to bless me with good kids. That's all I ever wanted in life. And you didn't answer my prayers. Jesus, I voted for you. And you didn't come through on your campaign promises. When in reality, Jesus actually tries to warn us not to give your full allegiance to family and tribe and marriage. Look at what else he does. This is fascinating. The other great idol is self. If you don't hate your own life in comparison to me, you cannot be my disciple. So some people, they don't exalt family and marriage. They swing the other way and they exalt the liberty and the fulfillment of the individual at the expense of family. Right? Can you think of a culture like this? We live in that culture, right? And so you end up with people that don't actually care about proximity to family. They typically gravitate towards urban cultures like Norman. Austin, Texas, Seattle, places like this. You know, the free spirits, the people that I'm talking about, they're not rooted anything. They're wanderers. And they're in search for whatever that it is that will fulfill their highest allegiance, which is self. They float from relationship to relationship, from job to job, from church to church. Whichever church gives them the spiritual fulfillment that they prefer during that season of their life, that's where they want to be. And you end up with a culture of people that can't find fulfillment because they are constantly in search of it. And Jesus says, if your allegiance is to family, you're going to be broken. If your ultimate allegiance is to self, you're going to hit a rock wall. Because there's no job or music career or teaching career or whatever it is that you're searching for. You might find a great job. But then you'll reach your 40s and you'll get disappointed. You'll get jaded with life. You know what I mean? This is so many people's story. And Jesus knows this. And he knows that all other allegiances only find their proper place when they're beneath your allegiance to him. And so he says, you cannot be my disciple because you won't be able to see clearly through the storm if your ultimate allegiance lies with family or with self. Jesus is not a politician. Jesus is a guide, and he challenges us, do you actually intend to take a different path than what the majority of people are going down? You see, there's this great crowd before him, and he says, the majority of people are pursuing family, and they're pursuing self. Are you going to follow me down this different path? Paul makes this beautiful statement in Galatians 2 and verse 20. We sing this all the time. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. You see, there's a sense of identity there that no one can ever take from him. It doesn't matter if your family falls apart. It doesn't matter if your job falls apart, because the Son of God loves you and gave himself for you. And that alone will lead to true life. So Jesus knew this would be difficult to avoid the idols of family and self, which is why he says what he says next. Now, don't miss this. For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, "Ha ha, that man began to build and was not able to finish." Or what king, going out to encounter another king in war, will not sit down and deliberate whether he's able to, with 10,000, to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the others yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciples. Don't miss this. He tells two parables here, stories that you're probably familiar with. But I realized after reading them closely that I was actually off on my understanding of them. The theme is counting the cost. If you're going to start something, if you're going to be my disciple, you need to sit down and you need to count the cost. It may cost you everything you have. It may even cost you your life, so follow me. And Jesus is like, you need to think that through. You need to be intentional about it. But here's what I've often missed when studying these verses. Of course, Jesus means you need to sit down and you need to count the cost. You need to be intentional about it. You can't just show up in the crowd and expect to be a disciple of Christ. But notice the parables here. The builder starts to build, and the king goes off to war. But both of them come up short, don't they? Neither one of them has what it takes, do they? The whole emphasis of the story, the guy sits down, he does sit down, and he does count the cost, but he realizes, I don't have enough. The king lays out a plan for war, but realizes, oh man, I can't win this war. I don't have enough people. So Jesus tells us to count the cost, but he also tells us that no matter which calculator we use, we're going to come up short. No matter when you sit down to count the cost, your numbers aren't going to add up. You are not going to be able to do it. You see that? Both parables are about counting the cost and not having enough. So once you count the cost of becoming a disciple of Jesus, you inevitably realize, I don't have what it takes. I can't do it. It's hard. And then he makes this bizarre statement about giving up everything, because your everything is not enough. And guess what? That's the conclusion he wants you to draw. That's the conclusion he wants you to come to. You confused yet? Jesus did this a number of times in his teaching. He's calling people to be his disciples, yet he's fully aware that they're only equipped with 10,000 men, and they're going up an army that's going against an army that's much greater than that. And there's a reason for this. It's because Jesus wants us to understand what is impossible for us is possible with God. When you sit down and you do the mental math of whether or not you can follow Jesus, you will come to the conclusion, I can't do it. I simply can't do it. I don't have what it takes to build that tower. I don't have a big enough army to fight that war. And that is precisely what Jesus wants you to do. That's precisely where he means you to be. Because when I realize that the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me, and I can't do this, he moves towards me in that moment. And it's in that moment that my allegiance to him trumps every other allegiance. It trumps all of my self-allegiance, where I think I'm good enough to do this. Because here's the thing. Some of us actually believe that we can follow Jesus. You actually think that you can forgive everyone that's ever wronged you. that you can fast and give and pray without ceasing, and that you can serve everyone and go on mission trips and continue not to sin. And maybe you can actually do this for, you know, an amount of time. And the reason you believe that is because you're in your 20s. But you can't sustain that. And if you believe that way, you're creating a recipe for religious burnout, which will lead to hypocrisy. It will. Or it's a recipe to become a rigid religious moralist. And you can actually look down on people who don't serve and follow the laws as good as you feel you do. You sat down, you counted the cost, you're building your tower. Why are they not building their tower the way that I'm building my tower? Then you just end up with a community of people who are excited about all the great things they've done for Jesus. That's not what Jesus is looking for. So some people exalt family. Some people exalt tribe. Some people exalt self-fulfillment. And then some people exalt their religious performance, and they give their allegiance to that. And Jesus says, look, if you actually count the costs, you realize you can't have the right heart and the right mindset all the time. You can't do all the right things all the time. And if I'm honest with myself, half the time we don't even want to, do we? But if you're humble and you come to the cross and you realize that you can't climb this mountain on your own, that you have to have a guide, that you have to have someone help carry your burdens, Jesus' response to that is, okay, now you're ready. Now you're ready to follow me. That's disciple material right there. That's where I wanted you to be the entire time. It's the moment when I recognize I don't add up, that Jesus meets me in my humility and my brokenness, and that he died and he gave himself for me. Now we can begin. Because now what I do is not about pleasing anyone anymore. It's not about honoring family or self-fulfillment. It's about a response. It's simply a response to the love that I've shown through Christ. And when I fail, you know, I get up and I ask for forgiveness, and we keep moving forward with him. It's the journey of being a disciple. I'm going to fall down, and Jesus is going to pick me up and keep moving forward up the mountain. That's what being a disciple looks like. If you can begin to root yourself in that place every single day, if you can begin to find your identity in him in that way, it's going to begin to overflow from you. You will actually begin to work harder at your job because you want to honor him for what he's done for you. It's amazing how this works. You will actually begin to serve people better, not because of what you can get out of it or how they can serve you, but because you're aware of the one who came to serve you. And you find, paradoxically, that the more you're trying not to be religious and do religious acts, the more you actually follow Jesus. The more you depend on him, the more you actually become like him. And then you fell, of course, and you feel horrible. And once again, you rely on Jesus to completely pick you back up and move forward. It's a lot. I know, it's a lot. But it's so powerful. Now, for me and you, maybe there are different things that we need to hate. It may not be family, it may not be self, it may not be your own life. It may be something else that you need to recognize has your ultimate allegiance. Whatever that blank is for you, what do you need to fill that blank in with? What has your ultimate allegiance above Jesus, and you need to give it up? Because here's what Jesus is saying. You can't find life in that. That will be a dead end. And it won't just happen. This isn't just going to happen just because you show up here. This isn't going to happen just because you're in the crowd. You have to choose it. You have to act on it. You have to actively follow Jesus. You have to have faith and trust in our guide, the one who's leading you through difficult paths, but is ultimately leading you to life, true life, eternal life. What has your ultimate allegiance? If it's not Christ, we want to help you as your family to demote that thing or to demote that person and put Christ as your ultimate allegiance. We're going to pray for you. That's what our family's for, to help each other, to support one another. Maybe you're here this morning and you have not even started following Christ, but you want to be in him. You want to be his disciple. You want to be forgiven of your sins. You want to receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. You do that through trusting in him and through proclaiming his name and through being buried in the waters of baptism, just as Christ was buried and was raised on the third day. If we can help you in any way, we would love to do that. As we stand